Lydia Compton, and I'm in Las Vegas with my husband, who's doing the IPEC education programs. And I wanted to share about my life in hopes that maybe somebody can get some value from it, some benefit. And anyway, just here goes. My life began in Ohio, in a small town called Franklin, had about 6,000 people in it. And I was there until I was like fourth grade. And that's where I first learned about God and creation, and God's creation. My mom was a person who really loved God and really loved creation. And so every Sunday, at least, she would take my brother and me on long walks in nature and point out the names of all the flowers and the birds and the bushes and the trees and everything like that, and just shared her heart of love for creation with me and with my little brother. And that was a routine every week we would do on Sundays after church. I was in the fourth grade, we moved to Richmond, Indiana, which is a bigger community, maybe 40,000 at that time. And the main thing of my relationship with God at that time developed beyond just about creation. At that point, I began to hear and learn about God through music. And it's very interesting, from my early time, there's this one song which we still sing these days that was really deep for me because I remember it from my childhood. I'm not going to sing the whole song, but I'm just going to sing a couple of passages so you know what I'm talking about. This is my Father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature sings and round me rings the beauty of his spheres. That's enough. Anyway, was a song that was sung in West Richmond Friends Meeting House every Sunday when I was a child growing up in a Quaker meeting. And my brother and my mom and I would sit in the pews, and that song would be sung often. And Quaker meetings, I don't know if you know, but Quaker meetings don't have a single minister, a single pastor. They have a team of people who... they're called the elders of the community, and they sit in what's called the facing bench, sort of like this, and everybody else is out here. And people out of the silence, there's a lot of silent meditation, and out of the silence people can speak from their own inspirations about God. But for me, all of that was kind of over my head. I was pretty young, and the main thing that went into me, I think, was the music, that song that I just sang and other songs. But it was kind of how I first got to know God a little bit more. And then the next stage in my life of relationship with God was when I went to camp, a Girl Scout camp, maybe elementary school age, something like that. And this time also, music was part of it, but this time it was about singing together with people more. Like Peace of the River, peace I ask of thee, O river, peace, peace, peace. So that was a touched my heart in those days, those kind of songs, and I really felt God when I was young in those ways. So then after I grew a little bit older, the next stage of my life of development with God was in my relationship with my uncle. My parents were divorced when I was 2 years old, so I didn't ever have a father exactly when I was growing up. So I just had my uncle, Uncle Bob, and Uncle Bob was an administrative assistant administrator for a college or something like that. I never really knew his position, but he was very smart. He was very down-to-earth, very humble man, and he and his wife took care of my mother and my brother and me, a family, every weekend, every holiday, every summertime. Anyway, he's the one who taught me how to fish, how to put the hooks on, how to put the bait on, how to cast the rod, catch the fish, how to make the fish come in, how to pull them out of the water, how to catch them, how to take them off the hook, how to clean them, scrape them off and cut off the head, and how to fillet them and how to cook them. So I learned the whole schmeal when I was maybe 10 years old, something like that, how to take care of fish. And he also taught me about rocks. He was a geology buff, and he liked to collect rocks, and he bought my brother and me a little tumbler that we could roll the rocks around in until they got smooth and shiny and beautiful. And he taught us about fossils, and he taught us about a lot of things in creation that way. And he also began to teach us about responsibility, about taking responsibility more than my mom, who was so busy taking responsibility herself, she didn't have time to teach us herself. But he taught a little bit about responsibility. And in fact, he gave me my first job. And I was 12 years old, my first job. I was he was an administrator for a college, what was a predecessor to the community college. It was a night school. They didn't have community colleges yet, but he was organized that. And every night they would have classes that people had to come to. And so obviously coffee is very helpful for classes to keep people awake in the evenings. So my job was to come, big tub of coffee with the thing in the top, get the water and put in it, put the coffee in and start it up before the classes started every day. So that was my job. It was a pretty big job for a 12-year-old girl. But I lived across the street from the college and across the street where it was, so it was just a quick run across and back. So it wasn't that hard, but it was a bit of a challenge for a 12-year-old. Anyway, so responsibility came into my life at that point. And school was going well. I was a pretty good student, not great, not A's, but B's usually. I think in my whole life, in high school, up to high school, I only had one D. That was in geography, which I feel really funny about now because I think I should have been more interested, but I guess the teacher was just so awful that I couldn't take it in. Because since then, I've been very interested in it. But anyway, at that time, I wasn't. So the next part of my life, from the time that I graduated from high school and went to college, basically the next 7 years, God went underground. It wasn't his fault. I was giving him too much of a hard time, and so he had to go underground because I couldn't relate to him, and I cut everything off. I asked one of my college professors, why should I believe in God? And my college professor said, well, if there's a God and you believe in him, then great. If there's a God and you don't believe in him, you might have a bad time. But somehow that wasn't a strong enough argument. By this point, I didn't think that made much difference. I mean, there's no God, so what's the difference with this whole thing anyhow? So I decided that God didn't exist, and I just decided that I could do what I wanted to do and proceed my life that way. So for 7 years, roughly, I did that, what I wanted to do, and God was very much underground. And I'm sure he tried in many ways to connect and get me to open my heart and mind to him, but he didn't have much success. I was pretty resistant and pretty determined to do what I wanted to do. But somehow, in spite of myself, at a certain point, not right away, but basically after about 7 years of wandering around and doing a lot of stupid things and being really irresponsible, doing all the things that I knew I wasn't supposed to do, abusing nature, abusing myself, abusing my friends, really many, many ways not being what God's daughter should be like. And so I feel a lot of pain about that time, and I think God, I'm sure, did as well. But it was really pretty clear that Satan invaded, and Satan had a lot to say and a lot to do with me for a time. It really jerked me around and gave me a lot of pain and a lot of difficulties, a lot of depression and confusion and misdirected activities, a lot of things. But somehow, after all of that, there was a point where I was open to some extent, and I don't know exactly how I got to that place, but I came, my friend, who I had met in after college, wrote a letter saying that she had found a community, and they were growing their own vegetables and giving foods and vegetables and fruits to the community centers, the places where people could come for homeless people who could come get food. And they were doing a lot of good service things, and they had their own, ran the farm themselves, and they had other businesses. And it sounded interesting, so I decided to visit my friend, who, it turns out, was bringing me to the Unification Church, to Oakland, California. At that point, it was called, I believe, New Education Development, which is, I'm not sure, that was a very short-lived name for the place, but anyway, I joined at that time. Went to Hearst Street and heard Ricky Joswick play the band with some other guys. Heard Dr. Durst give his first lecture, and he told the elephant story, which probably everyone has heard about, you know, all the different ways you can approach the elephant and figure out what it is, and everybody has a different idea, so that was intriguing to me. In college, I had majored in philosophy, so one of the good things that happened for my college was that I got an education, and by having the education, especially in philosophy, it kind of focused the questions for me about God, about truth, about reality, about what's the meaning of life and those things, but it didn't give any clear answers, at least not any permanent ones, because every new philosopher you heard would contradict the guy who came before and would say what was wrong with his argument and then present his own, and then the next guy coming after would contradict, and it was like a continuous thing of back and forth for years. So when I left college, I had, in behind everything else, a kind of intellectual curiosity about what happens next, because I had the whole course of philosophical history up to the present, but I didn't know what was going to come next. And I kind of gotten depressed about the direction it was going in, because I don't know if anybody knows about it, but philosophy in, up to the 20th century became more and more atheistic and more secular and opening the doors to communism and a lot of negative things. So I was getting disappointed in philosophy about the same time as I graduated from college, and that didn't help any of the things I was trying to deal with. So when I heard the divine principle in a very, very rudimentary form at Oakland, just kind of principles of education, a very simplistic version, it still touched some of the basic things, the basic questions that I had been dealing with. And I felt like the answers were there, that all the questions that had come up through all the studying that I had done and couldn't find answers, I felt, oh, this is it. This is the answers. These are the answers. This follows things through. This carries things into the future. This makes sense. And so I had to stay. I had, you know, it was my intellect was intrigued. I was inspired by the people. Of course, they're a really nice community. Everybody is very nice. And my brother says they smiled too much, but I enjoyed it. And anyway, it was a very good opening for me into the our movement. And I guess you could say that God kind of peeked out from his underground position a little bit and began to try to open my heart and open my mind and open me into understanding his love and all the things that he had to offer. But it was a really long process. I joined in August of 1974, and I did a lot of different things, which I'll a little bit talk about, but it wasn't until actually August or July of 2012, August 2014, when I really fell in love with God. So it was a long course. It's like 40 years of basically doing humble servant of servant type of work, most of it. I think most of us in our movement did a lot of that for a long time. It's nothing unique to me, but when I look back, I realized that I was paying indemnity for the 7 years. I realized that because my attitude had been so bad, that I had to pay greater indemnity, as we know in divine principle. When you do things with the right sincere heart, then God can maybe forgive more easily and you don't have to pay the full price. Might have even been able to connect like within a year or within 7 months or something, but because my heart was not sincere, then God had to ask me to go the longer course. So I think I have an amazing mom. I actually have amazing ancestors, and I have an amazing mom, because I know there's no way on my own, considering where I was when I met this movement, that I could have stuck with it. So I think my mom was praying consistently, and I think there was an incredible foundation among my ancestors to keep me on the path. So it was hard, I think, a lot of times. I can kind of remember, a lot of it's very vague, because I think I was coming out from under such a big cloud of darkness that a lot of it I don't have in my mind any yet again. I mean, some things are opening up, and I'm beginning to see glimpses back. But a lot of things I don't remember clearly, because I think there was a kind of fog by my fallen life in front of me. So anyway, when I finally did find God, in the sense that when I finally felt that I was kind of back with God the way I had been as a child, a little bit like that feeling, was when I first saw our true Father, and actually not saw him, but was close enough to have a connection, internal connection with him. So most of the time when I was in the movement, whenever we'd go to see true parents, I would go to the back of the room because I didn't feel I was worthy to sit in front. And I could never understand how people felt so just empowered to go sit in front every week, every day, every time Father spoke. Some people just plopped themselves right in front of me. How audacious. How can they be like that? How could they sit like that in front of Father every time and not, you know, feel any kind of embarrassment or shame about it? Because I felt like, oh, I don't have any claim to be in front of Father that close. So I always was in the back. So consequently, since I was always in the back, I didn't really connect internally with what Father was saying. I could hear it, and I could understand it, and I could believe it, and I could trust it, and I could act on it, and I could do, and I could repeat it, and I could accept it completely, but I did not experience anything in my heart from Father at all for many, many years. And so when I finally did have the experience, which was in Cheongpyeong in 2012, July 26th, at the end of a workshop, Women's Federation had a workshop, and Father had spoken, and then there was this OSDP workshop that I attended right after. And I won't forget the date because it's one of the few dates that I remember, but July 26, 2012, because I went to Hunduke with Father. That was the first time I was in a room. It was about four times as big as this room, but the amazing thing was that I came in. There was only about 40 people from each morning. Father gave Hunduke for about an hour to the people in the OSDP workshop, and there were usually about 40 people in the room each time. And as usual, I went to the back. Not this far back, but to the back. But Dongwoo Kim's wife, at one point she was talking to another Korean sister. They were sitting together in the front before Father came in. And they were talking together, and then she turned around and she went like this to me. So, okay. And I got up and I went up, and she gave me a little lap robe and sat me down beside her. And Father was about as far away as Reverend Duba is now, just from me, that close. To me, that was intimate and very close type of experience. So I can't tell you much of anything that he said. Of course, this was kind of late in Father's life. In fact, the next month is when Father passed, you know, very shortly after I met him for the first time, and the first time I felt like I was part of his family. And I really felt like maybe I was one of the last people to become a new member of his family, one of the latest babies, but a pretty old baby. But anyway, he was talking about mathematics and directions, north, south, east, west, and all kinds of things. And I'm a fairly smart person, but I couldn't follow what he was doing at all. And I think a lot of people had that kind of problem in the end when Father was speaking, because a lot of what he was dealing with, I think, was probably kind of cosmic, spiritual world stuff that was a little bit beyond us earthly beings. But anyway, he was interesting, and I was just enthralled to be there, and I just felt so much love coming from him. And when he spoke, and I listened very closely, and I didn't take notes, which I usually did, which would make me down like this, and I wouldn't have seen anything or been able to have eye contact with him or anything. So I didn't have notes, and I didn't do that. I actually looked at him, and I could see his eyes, and I could communicate internally with him. I could feel his love as a parent towards me, and it was really a precious, precious moment. And but I don't think I really understood about God so much even in that moment. I think it was about Father, but it wasn't so much about God. Anyway, I hadn't made the connection yet. So when Father left the room after he spoke, well, first he was sitting there, and Mother was right next to him. And I wasn't really paying so much attention to Mother, but she was there. I was aware of her. And at one point, one of the grandchildren, the little boy, was on Father's lap for a while, and then he got off and was running around, and was trying to go underneath the table where Father was sitting. And Mother got up from her seat and went around and picked him up and took him back to the back of the room and gave him to one of the nannies. And I had the feeling that she was a little bit annoyed that they had let him be in there loose with Father and nobody was there. She had to get up and go take care of it. But she didn't say she was annoyed or anything. I just felt like she should have been if she wasn't, because it wasn't, she shouldn't have had to do that. But it was very motherly, and I appreciated it. She did it. And I felt like, you know, Father's so old, and maybe it would have not been so good if the little boy was kind of crawling around under his legs and stuff. Maybe it would have, you know, maybe it would have hurt him in some way. So anyway, I didn't know why, but she did that. Anyway, then Father finished speaking, and he was sitting, and he wanted to, and he was supposed to leave, and two men, big men, came to help him get up and walk out the room. But he said no to both of them, and he got himself up from the table. But they did help him out of the room and, you know, hold him as he went out the room. But what was really funny was when he got almost to the door on his way out the room, and he turned around and went, and he spat, and the spit came on me and a couple of other people. Oh, gosh, what a treat, you know. The Messiah spittle on your face, right? It was an amazing experience. So that was, yeah, that was the beginning of my relationship with God through our true Father. And then for the next couple of years, I was kind of floating a little bit in that experience. You know, I would bring it back to my mind and keep myself lifted up that way by remembering that. And then, I don't know, one thing I didn't tell you about my family was that they were very patriotic. My family is extremely patriotic. And in 1964, I worked for Barry Goldwater, running for president, which was very conservative, very Republican, very pro-American type of candidate. I went door-to-door putting out flyers and leaflets as a high school junior. But as I said before, when I went to college, my perspective changed, and I worked for Eugene McCarthy on the other side of the spectrum. That was a crazy year. James told us in his testimony about his experiences in Vietnam while I was on the other side trying to keep get us out of there, and, you know, all the things that were going on. And but that year, I think maybe even crazier than this year politically, because changes of candidates, and Kennedy was assassinated, Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and so many things happened, and none of the original players ended up being the ones who were elected in the end. It was Hubert Humphrey wasn't even one of the original candidates, but he ended up being the one who was elected. So anyhow, crazy year. But the patriotism that I had went through both ends of the political spectrum. I felt I was working for America when I was doing both things. I felt I'm working for America. I want America to be great. So, so when in 2014, when the God's Hope for America tour was announced, my patriotic ancestors and my patriotic spirit became so intense that I begged and pushed and cajoled until my husband finally said, yes, you can go. And we'll figure out how to pay for it. We'll send you there. And they made the arrangements, and I was able to, not to go for the whole tour, but I was able to join in Florida and go until Minnesota, and which was basically 3 weeks I was on that tour. And that was the time in which my relationship with God was deepening, and I was beginning to fall more and more in love with God and realize how God was working in my life and how he had been working and how things are in this world, and what role I might have to play, and what the world needs. And Bishop Kim says America is God's hope for the world was one of the quotes he came with. We were talking about God's hope for America. How can we make America great? But he brought that other vision into the mix, and it made me realize that, yeah, America has an amazing, huge role and responsibility in fulfilling what God needs at this time, because the kingdom can't happen unless all people are part of it, and we have so much wealth and so much blessing in this country, and so much ability, so much talent, everything this country has, and the education system and everything we have is so much, much more than any place else in the world. Even Europe, I think, is too broken up in compartments to be able to do what this country can do. So I just, I became really acutely, intensely passionate about that part of our providential role through those 3 weeks that I was on the tour. So every day we would go on the bus in the morning from 8 o'clock, and we'd get off at 8 o'clock at night, and we'd stop periodically at different places, and we'd have rallies and sing God Bless America and a few other songs, and have prayers and short talks all around the country. Every day, one or two places. Sangmoo was there teaching us all Korean, which was very helpful. Mm-hmm. And everyone had a deep experience. And I felt like Mike Balcom was an amazing leader, teacher, guide in that time. He really really was like a father for the bus, really took care of everyone and guided things very well. And he was always ready to come out of the bus and greet the new people. Each new time we came, he was always ready to go out and greet the new community that we were coming into next. And after a while, they started doing this thing at the bus. They rolled out a red carpet out for the bus, and we would all come out on the red carpet into the midst of the people and to join them with the prayer and the music and all that. These stops were all at holy grounds that Father had created in 1965, and I think they came here to Las Vegas, but that was before I joined the tour, so I didn't come for that part. But so we went to many, many holy grounds in that time. 21 days, we went to one at the Capitol, we went to one at, we went to pray at Danbury, we went to Plymouth Rock, Niagara Falls, so many places around the country we stopped and we had prayers. And since my American ancestors are very passionate and patriotic, they were, I'm sure, inspired the whole time. And that's why it was an uplifting experience for me, is because they were right there sitting on my shoulders saying, yeah, this is great, and pushing us forward. So I really felt a lot of inspiration and hopefulness and wisdom, I think, coming from Mike Balcom and thinking about what we were trying to do. And I felt like we really were kind of waking up the spirit that Father had planted when he put the rocks in the ground and all the holy grounds around the country. I felt like we were, you know, coming and touching that and bringing, like, the flames coming up again, so that America as a nation could come up and could become, could take its role and responsibility as a providential nation that it's supposed to be. So that was in 2014, and we found out, then I worked with a little while with my husband finally, after being married and blessed for many, many years. We were blessed in 1982, Madison Square Garden blessing. But he is a fundamentalist Mooney, and so he has always been extremely passionate to do his mission. And we had four kids, and so a lot of the time we didn't intersect. Our paths in the daytime didn't intersect so much. Late at night, early morning, but in between, it was separate course, right? So the thing that happened here in Las Vegas is we've actually had a chance to become husband and wife, kind of in reverse order, because normally people come together as a couple before they start having their family. But in our case, it was kind of like the reverse, because we were together, but we weren't really together much of the time. So we're kind of now beginning to get to know all of our annoying points, which we didn't see for many years. So anyway, it's great fun. We're in Las Vegas, and everything that happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas, right? I think I just blew it, didn't I? Anyway, God is really amazing and very precise. His love is very precise. It's not general. People a lot of times talk about God's love, like the embrace of God's love, and that's there. But God's love is very precise, very particular. Each person, their own particular way of being loved by God, what they need, a particular experience that they need to be able to grow. And in my experience, there were so many times when it could have gone one way or the other in my life, and yet it seems how somehow God knew exactly how to make sure I did the right thing, make sure I went past the barrier that was there, or the obstacle or whatever that was keeping me from growing. But anyway, I don't want to say my job is finished or I've completed my role or my growth is over or anything like that, but I do feel like I've come to a new plateau in my life, and I feel like this is a time for me to grow and expand what I've come to. It's not a time to, I don't have to climb the ladder as intensely as I did before, but I do have, of course, to keep trying one step in front of the other, to keep going to do what God needs, and that's what I'm about now. Thank you very much.